Please turn with me in your Bibles to the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 9, beginning in verse 13. We have extraordinary discoveries before us, reminders that we have to do with God when we open the scriptures. Verse 13, "And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, Loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000. And I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire, and of jacinth, and brimstone. And the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions. And out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. By these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth, and in their tails. For their tails were like unto serpents, and had heads, and with them they do hurt. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils, and idols of gold, and silver, and brass, and stone, and of wood, which neither can see, nor hear, nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts." I don't know how it seems to you, but it seems to me as if we have been away from Revelation for some time, being taken up with other matters. But remember, our focus up to this point has been upon verses 13 and 14. We spent quite a bit of time considering the significance of the place from which this terrible voice comes. Verse 13, "And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God." You remember that there were but three services that pertained to these four horns on the golden altar. And two of them had to do with public sins of ignorance. This is how you would deal with a sin of ignorance once it was discovered in ancient Israel and according to the ceremony that God had given his people. There would be a confession of that sin, a solemn acknowledgement, with the hand rested upon the substitutionary sacrifice. The animal would be slain. So there would be expiation and atonement unto the forgiveness of the sin of ignorance. There would be the cleansing of the meeting place. The sins of the people were portrayed as defiling their meeting place with God. And that needed to be cleansed by blood so that there could be a comfortable fellowship with the Holy One of Israel. And then you remember the carcass, representative of the sin, was carried outside of the camp. So the sin was confessed. There was an atonement so that there could be forgiveness. There was the cleansing of the meeting place so that there could be comfortable fellowship and worship of God. And then that sin was carried away, put outside of the camp. So this was the remedy for the sin of ignorance. You remember we had occasion to observe that among the Christians of the East, what is now known as Eastern Orthodoxy, their sins, their idolatries, and remember they were fully participating in the martyr cult, the worship of departed saints and martyrs and invoking them as mediators. We might call this a fully anti-Christian idolatry, inasmuch as these martyrs were being taken as mediators, displacing the Christ. These sins were discovered to them by the Muslims, who would not tolerate this idolatry. And the Muslim plague did lead true Christians to reflect upon these things. Reformation-minded people began to raise the cry against the idolatry in their midst. Even the kings, you remember Leo the Isaurian, raised a cry against these things, and yet the East repented not. The sin that had formerly been committed in ignorance was now discovered. They refused to apply the ceremony, and now the cry goes from the neglected altar for judgment, very much the way that when Abel's blood soaked into the ground, it was portrayed as, this is the spot of the sin, and that spot was portrayed as crying out to God for judgment. Here the four horns of the altar are the place of sin. They are neglected. And from that place the cry goes out for judgment. The content of the cry was for the sixth trumpeting angel to loose the four angels that were bound at the great river Euphrates. And remember, we considered the question, who were these four angels? This is where we left things that were formerly bound, but now being loosed. And if you'll remember, these were the same four destroying angels that we met in Revelation chapter 7, commissioned to hurt the Roman world and the apostatizing visible church. So here, after the Constantinian Revolution, the church has this massive influx of non-believers. The church is now thickly sown with tares. It takes a very worldly direction. And then you find the four menacing, destroying angels. We have lost sight of the angels in the vision, their persons, but not their effects. When we consider the first five trumpets, we see that they have been carrying out their commission. And there have been terrible judgments upon the Roman world. Now they come back into view. You remember that the Saracen plague ended where? It ended with the transfer of the capital from Syria to the Euphrates. At that point, the Saracens stopped their vexatious stinging of the Roman world. So, figuratively, the angels are portrayed as bound at the Euphrates. They had been free in their commission, but now they have been stopped for a period of centuries. There they have waited and they have rested. But after the respite, those angels are going to be loosed once again from Euphrates. And they are going to renew their commission to do hurt to the Roman world. This morning we're going to be looking at verse 15. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year, for to slay the third part of men. So I want you to notice the main clause of this sentence is, and the four angels were loosed. So the call comes from the horns of the altar for judgment, and the call is effectual. The call was to loose those four angels that were bound there, and now those angels are indeed loosed from the Euphrates. So when we look for fulfillment, we want to see a historical fulfillment that will show their loosing, or that the judgment begins from the Euphrates. So we have one of our markers, and one that is quite specific. So help us know that we're in the right place. And then these angels are further described as having been prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year. This is going to require some work in your thinking caps, but not all of the oracles of God are easy. Interestingly enough, I'm going to work somewhat backwards here, but there are several different Greek words for a year. Long discussion, but this one does imply the idea of a revolution, so I do think it's rightly taken as a solar year. A lot of times the people of the East would have 12 lunar months of 30 days, so a year of just 360. But this one, this word implies a revolution, and so we take it for a solar year. Now here we're going to be very specific, but I do think all of the wonder is in the specificity of the prophecy. Now a solar year would be 365 days, and then just under a fourth part of another day. So it's 365 days and about 6 hours. It's actually just under 6 hours, 5 hours and some change. By the year-day principle, if you were to turn this into years, as we've already seen in the fulfillment, taking days for years, this would be 365 years plus another quarter year, just under a quarter year, 5 hours and some change, 88 days. E.B. Elliott actually gives you the exact 5 hours and so many minutes and so many seconds, and then he transfers those into days, would be 88 days. A month is easier. That would be 30 days, which would be representative of 30 years. The day would be one day. That would be 1 year. And then the hour is a little bit more difficult. The people of the East would normally say that the day consists of 12 hours, not 24, because they didn't count the hours of the night, generally speaking. So we've got a 12th of a day here, which would be, in a year, 30 days. When you put all of these things together, as you see by your computation, that would be 396 years and 118 days. Very specific. Especially if we're understanding this right. Now, the purpose for which they have been prepared is to slay the third part of men. This is quite different than the fifth trumpet. You remember in the fifth trumpet, the Saracens had been commissioned to hurt and vex, but not to destroy Roman government. To sting, like scorpions, but not to kill. And remember, the fifth trumpet was expressly was express on that point. Not to kill, but to sting and to vex. They will wish that they were dead, but it will not destroy Roman government. But here the commission is to slay. And once again, you remember from our earlier studies, we saw that the Roman Empire in the vision is properly broken up into three parts. Not just two, not just the sort of traditional East-West division, but you have the Western Roman Empire. And then you remember Illyricum, and then the Eastern Empire. And all three had, if you will, distinct destinies, one from another. And here we see the destroying of a third part of the empire. So one third part had already been destroyed, government taken away. And now the other third part in the Eastern Empire, we expect a killing or a slaying of the third part of men, the removal of government altogether in the Eastern Empire. As I was studying this, I do think, I don't want to lose you by adding a lot of detail, so I'm going to give you some principal dates by way of historical fulfillment. And we'll probably, in coming days, as we continue to work on this, we'll fill in some of the gaps, but what's really important to understand the wonder of this prophecy is the beginning and the end, the beginning and the ending of it. So first of all, we did some history after this, but our last great historical marker was the year 762, when the Eastern Caliph moved his capital from Syria, and while he was in Syria, he was in constant conflict with the Roman Empire. He moves from there to Baghdad on the Euphrates. And it's at that point that the time of the stinging and tormenting of Christendom is over. And as we had it, the angels are portrayed as being bound there, no longer, or at least for the time being, to do their destructive work upon the Roman Empire. The next really significant date, as far as the apocalypse is concerned, would be December of 1055, Toghril Beg, he was a Turkish warlord, and here you have the rise of the Turks. When you think of the Turks, you want to think of a collection of people groups around the Black and Caspian Seas and even northwards. If you can picture Asia Minor slightly eastward and northward, Black and Caspian Sea and the peoples that are around there, there's a handful of them, but united and frequently called Turks. Toghrulbeg took Baghdad from the last of the Saracen caliphs. Basically, the Saracen caliph had asked him for help, and Toghril gave him more than just a little help. He came in and basically took things over. He relegates the caliph to being a mere figurehead, and the caliph was happy to give him the power and the authority to do these things. And with Toghril and the coming of the Turks, new life was blown into the Islamic movement and the Islamic religion. Toghril is in Baghdad for about 13 months. He has to consolidate his power, and part of that started with a massive celebration as he's coronated and installed and all of these sorts of things. So there's this massive celebration, but what he is doing and the reason that he delays is he's consolidating Islamic power to himself. And at the end of 13 months, and I want you to mark very particularly, 1057, and we know this from the Arab historians, the date is very specific, January 18th, Toghril begins to extend by military force Islamic power back into Roman lands. He starts to move westward. I do believe that this would be the proper date of the release of the angels from their bondage, from their chains at the Euphrates River, and destruction is coming to the Roman Empire again, the Eastern Third in particular. Now we skip over a lot of history to 396 years later, and exactly 396 years later, and some odd days, we'll talk about that in just a moment. 1453, May 29th specifically, Constantinople falls to the Turks. This is a very important and memorable event. The Western Roman Empire had fallen a long time ago, but the Eastern capital had stood for another 1,000 years, and only now does it fall. But this would be the destruction of the body politic of one-third of the men of what used to be the Roman Empire. Now, if you count the days specifically, it would be 396 years and 130 days. Now remember, the apocalypse told us to expect 118 days. But a couple of considerations here. The actual fall of Constantinople when the Turks take it is just 12 days more than what we had in the prophetic calendar. But if the apocalypse had said 2 hours and a month, and a day and a month and a year, it would have been 18 days too much. Actually, you know, 1 hour would have been the more exact counting. And I think it might mar some of the beauty of the prophecy to say, you know, so many minutes and an hour. And so it's actually closest to an hour. But another way of reckoning this, to show you just how close it is, the history, if you counted out the apocalyptic hours, was 4,755 and one quarter hour. In Revelation, it's 4,755 hours. So you see the close correspondence there between the two of them. But I wonder if something else is not going on here. As Eliot points out, and this is very striking, you might ask the question, well, what was going on the 118th day of that 396th year? What was going on in that very day that the apocalypse told us to look for? Muhammad II, and it's interesting that it's a Muhammad, Muhammad II had already besieged, this was the 40th day of the siege of Constantinople. So it's the 40th day of the siege. He had besieged it by land. But for the first time, He put galleys, war galleys, in the harbor and began to bombard the seawall. And so now Constantinople was fully surrounded. Given our unintending interpreter of the apocalypse says this: after a siege of 40 days, the fate of Constantinople could no longer be averted. This was the turning point when it was clear that Constantinople wasn't going to escape this time. And now the prince actually reaches out and begins to want to talk peace treaty. And, we'll be your subjects, we'll be subservient, but don't take the city from us, and this sort of thing. All of which was rejected. But the 40th day, interestingly enough, was de facto the time that Constantinople fell. And it's very striking, just the number of years and just the number of days. 12 days later, it would be fully in the hands of the Turks. So, by any reckoning, 1 hour, 1 day, 1 month, 1 year was the best representation, better than any other, unless you were going to be even more minute in your details. But even this very day was very significant in the prophetic calendar. And by way of doctrine, I wanted to take two things away. I don't know if I have done an adequate job conveying to you just the wonder of the specificity of this prophecy, but it is an absolute marvel. And the fact that the Lord has been pleased to preserve the beginning point and the end point as markers in history so that we can still find them and trace them. We have not followed cunningly devised fables. Our religion is real. There is a real God in heaven, and He has spoken to us in the Scripture. And who but a God and the true and living God could foretell such an event with such a precision down to the very hour? And if you had been living in the intervening centuries, you wouldn't have expected it actually to take that long. The natural expectation is that Constantinople would have fallen to the Turkish power much earlier than this. Let me try to give you just some snapshots of the intervening centuries. It makes it all the more striking, all the more remarkable. As we saw under the Saracens, the Eastern Empire was already decaying. It wouldn't take a whole lot to topple it at various points along the way. But God hindered the Turks time and time again until the appointed hour. So the empire was propped up time and time again until the 1 hour, 1 day, 1 month, and 1 year had been fulfilled. Interestingly enough, Eliot gives a bit of a narrative when he said that this was a distinctively Turkish way of talking about time frames. When Saladin made peace with Richard of the Lionhearted, it was for something like 3 days, 3 hours, 3 months, and 3 years. This was a very distinctively Turkish way of describing times, and there was a treaty in those very words during that time. But interestingly enough, the Eastern Empire looked like it was going to collapse when the Crusades began. And so the fresh infusion of military strength from the West saved Constantinople and the Eastern Empire, propping it back up. That happened. That carried on for about 2 centuries. Looked like it was getting ready to collapse again. The Mongols coming out of the Asian plains under Genghis Khan provided enough trouble for the Turks to keep the Greek Empire going and Greek Christendom. And then finally, when it would seem like Constantinople was going to crumble 50 years too early, Tamerlane comes out of China and prevents it so that it falls out at just the hour. So if you had been living at the time, there was much political expectation that Constantinople would fall far before the prophesied time. And yet we find it down to the very hour, the thing that had been prophesied and decreed by the Most High God. So we say that the Scriptures are real. Our holy religion is real. And Christ, who prophesies such things and who can tell the end of things from the beginning, is worthy of our confidence and our trust in all things, great things and small things. And indeed, he is real and he is worthy for us to spend our lives upon him and upon his cause. Reflect upon these things, because it is the most striking witness of the divinity of the Scriptures. No man could prophesy such a thing. And the second doctrine, God's providence extends to all his creatures and all their actions. In your outline, you'll see Confession of Faith 5:1. God, the great creator of all things, doth uphold, direct, dispose, and govern all creatures, actions, and things, from the greatest even to the least, by his most wise and holy providence, according to his infallible foreknowledge and the free and immutable counsel of his own will, to the praise of the glory of his wisdom, power, justice, goodness, and mercy. And I was particularly thinking of that little phrase that God disposes all things from the greatest even to the least. Great matters of history, small details of history, all in the hands of God. And sometimes you'll hear infidels say things like, it's unworthy of God to take notice of these little tiny things. But it implies an economy of attention that doesn't properly apply to the divine being. It's actually a thought that's unworthy of God. When you think of a great man who's got a limitation in his attentions, you might think it's unbecoming of this man who's consumed with these great matters to descend to these fine details. But God is not a man who has a limitation upon his attention. He's the infinite God, infinitely intelligent, infinitely wise. And so he takes cognizance of matters great, and he takes cognizance of matters small. He takes cognizance of the fall of Constantinople, and he takes cognizance of every molecule that was involved in it through all of those centuries. Consider some of the great matters and also some of the details that had to pass out. But first, just the grand things. In this prophecy, the exact origin of this judgment is pointed out. It's going to be the Euphrates, and it's going to be after the passing of the Saracen power. And what do we find? At the very time that the Saracen power is passing, the Turkish power is rising, and it's going to rise in the exact same place where the Saracen power left off. The binding and the loosing of the same angels from that very place. We get the exact passage of time, not through a few moments, but through centuries, down to the very prophetic hour of the fulfillment. We are given the exact endpoint and the exact effect, the slaying of the third part of the men, the destruction of the Eastern Empire, its political and corporate end, its political and corporate death. Exact origin, exact passage of time, exact endpoint, and the exact effect that we were told to expect. But the Lord is not just the Lord of all of these grand events, but all of the, you can't say infinite properly, but the numberless factors and details that were necessary to have those events, only those events, exactly those events, at exactly those times. All of the factors that had to go into producing just that. There's an old proverb, for want of a nail, the shoe was lost. For want of a shoe, the horse was lost. For want of a horse, the rider was lost. For want of a rider, the message was lost. For want of a message, the battle was lost. For want of a battle, the kingdom was lost, and all for the want of a horseshoe nail. In order for God to be able to foretell specific events in the far future, He has to be controlling things down to the very atoms. Or to put it in another way, if there was one atom that was bouncing around this cosmos outside of the control of God, there would be some possibility that his prophecies would not be brought to pass and that his promises would not be fulfilled. He controls all of these things and he orchestrates them all to the very smallest detail. You might say some other things, like if there was no Genghis Khan, this wouldn't have happened in this way. But had to produce a Genghis Khan, you know, the parents need to meet, and you start to get down to very fine details and so on. Down to the very smallest details, God rules over all things. And to bring this very close to home, and for the comfort of all Christians, isn't it an amazing thing to think that all of these things, from the great events of history to the bouncing around of molecules, all of these things are orchestrated for our good? And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. Romans chapter 8, verse 28. The great things and the small things of your life are in his hand. And we don't always see all of the things. We don't always discern the times and the seasons. We don't understand all of the factors that are involved. We don't understand all of the reasons. But we are told that every one of these things falls out for our good. If we are lovers of God, if we have been called according to his purpose, then every one of these things falls out for our good. They are orchestrated by omnipotent wisdom for our profit. I would encourage you this afternoon, and this is the work that no preacher can do for you, I would encourage you to try to think of these things and apply them very personally and particularly. You might very well have certain sorts of things going on in your life. You don't understand why the Lord has left you in certain difficulties. You don't understand why he has left you with certain pains. You might very well want to think upon those things and then think upon Romans 8:28. I might not understand it. He's not promised to explain all of it to me. But he has told me that all of these things are for my good, that they will be spiritually profitable to me. And at the end of the things, I will look back and I will see the profit. It is good that the things fell out the way that they did. It was necessary for my spiritual advancement. Only you can do the personal work. In recent days for myself, I've been thinking much upon our congregation. We have had yet another very painful discipline in our midst. But the message of heaven to us is that this is good for us. It's not always easy to see how it will be good for us, or to always understand the reasons why this is the best thing for our spiritual development. But if you are a true believer in Jesus Christ, you're able to say, this is good for me, even if I don't understand all of the reasons. And one final thing, we have been reflecting much upon young people getting ready for marriage. And we have already talked about trusting God. But this brings us right back upon those same reflections. Temptations will come to marry and to marry somebody unsuitably. Those temptations largely arise out of our unbelief. We don't trust God. And so we're going to grab what he is not yet giving us. But consider, all of the events of your life, great and small, are in his hand. He has already decreed whether or not you will get married. Already decreed it. If you are to get married, he has already decreed to whom. And the when of it, down to the very hour and to the very minute. And so why are you so troubled? And why are you afraid? And why do you worry so? The Lord has already made a gracious provision of these things, and they will be fulfilled in his time. And we must believe this and trust his arrangement. Do you trust him? That it has been arranged very particularly, down to the very smallest detail, even the when of it, for our spiritual advancement and prosperity. I thought that we might sing a song of trust to our Good Shepherd, Psalm 23. Psalm 23 to the tune, Crimmend. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Please rise.